everybody. Welcome. This is Vicki from Show Dog Prep School, and tonight we're going to be talking about reactivity in dogs. So I have some professional dog trainer and behavior consultant friends, all dear friends and Show Dog Prep School contributors. So we have Hannah Pemberton from Canine Country Academy, Andrea Stone, who's now on her own doing confirmation stuff and making tags, Chelsea Murray with Positive Futures, and Paula Nowak, also with Canine Country Academy. So I just kind of wanted to start off this conversation by talking about what is reactivity, because isn't it funny that, I mean, we're all pro trainers, so we're the ones who get the phone call, right? That my dog is very aggressive on leash. Like, he is bad. Like, he is aggressive. And sometimes it's aggression and sometimes it's like some other things. So you guys want to just like kind of talk about the reactivity you've seen and what it's looked like. You want to start, Hannah?
Oh, well, I mean,
we'll just kind of, we can go.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what it looks like is usually people who kind of let it happen for a really long time. And so it's a pretty regular thing that usually there's one instance that just kind of pushes them to, you know, want to actually reach out. But a lot of it that I've found is, you know, this dog's been doing it for 3 years. Okay, let's try working on it now. And then if it's not
a lot of practice, a lot of practice behind that.
And not immediate results are like, oh, well, I thought this would be faster. I'm like, so it's a lot of practice of 3 years and 2 weeks of working on it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But, you know, we see big dogs, small dogs, you know, it doesn't really matter the size. When people get kind of to that point, they just want help to stop it.
So I'm going to kind of move around in a circle and then we'll just go free discussion. So Andrea, what do you, in your work with reactive dogs, and for me, it's been my own dogs as well as client dogs. So I have dogs of my own that are reactive. So what do you see in terms of behavior that you would call reactivity?
So most of the reactive behavior that I see in client dogs and my own dogs, and this is like pet dogs or even confirmation dogs, barking, lunging, jumping, you know, of course, you know, in a dog show environment, it's on leash. So it's usually barking or lunging or bouncing. And, you know, at home, it could be like fence running back and forth, you know, behind the fence or windows and just, you know, a lot of barking and lunging and sometimes grabbing, hopefully not, but sometimes that if they get real over aroused and out of their minds, they might grab at something too.
Mm-hmm. Like your pants or your leg?
Like your skirt, your skirt or, you know, your pant cuffs or, you know, if you're like, oh no, over here, they might get real sharky and grab the bait or toy out of your hand and be too hard. And
Real quick, I want to just make this point since you talked about dog shows. It's really interesting that dogs can be fine at dog shows. Fine meaning they don't explode at every dog, but they are reactive on walks. So some dogs I've found get used to, and it's more the appearance of a single dog. So I just wanted to point out you can have a dog that's like fine in some contexts.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, a dog that's great at dog shows, but out of his mind at, you know, coursing. Because
I think people forget, you know, dogs are so context specific, right? They're really bad at generalizing behavior and really good at discrimination. I see a lot of dogs that are great at dog shows because they understand the environment. They know what's going to happen. You don't see that behavior, but then you're walking in your neighborhood and here's one lone dog coming down the street and they go bonkers.
Yeah, exactly.
Pulling or whatever.
All right, I'm going to move on to Paula. And tell me, you know, what is your opinion on some of the things that you see in reactivity, like what behaviors you see, but also what do you think the causes are of it?
Sure. I think one thing that comes to mind, and I know we all agree on this, is when we say a reactive dog, we don't mean that the dog itself is reactive. It's a response to something in their environment. So we are very careful not to label dogs, but for the context of today's discussion, we say reactive dog because they're not reactive all the time, typically, if they're truly reactive. And what, you know, has already been discussed is over response to something that we would think is pretty common, seeing a dog or a trash can or, you know, something that's pretty benign, but they blow it up.
Yeah.
You know, picturing that right now. Like they blow it up out of the water and you're like, whoa. And so when I look at it, I look at the whole picture. Who is this dog? What's their DNA? Some breeds are more likely to be explosive. I live with terriers and now something's setting them off.
What is that noise? I thought it was Hannah with the puppy over there.
No, it's my house. But you know, DNA is going to play a role. And then also how they're raised, what happens in their world. Something either doesn't happen or does happen, right? So a lot of times we see dogs that are fine, okay, as puppies, so up to 6 months, and then 6 months hit, and all of a sudden they're at the end of the leash freaking out, but maybe we didn't address something or notice something as a puppy, and so the puppy's just like, you know what? I have to say something about this because it's never been addressed. So it's that nature and nurture. I don't see it as one thing. And so often people think like, oh, I did this to my dog. Lots of times you just don't know what you're looking at. And that's why it's important to get involved with professionals, because we can notice stuff early on to say, hey, that's a concern. And they might look shy initially, or easy puppies. Easy puppies always scare me. Oh, he's so easy. And you're like, oh, that's not good. That means something bad's gonna happen later. But that's what I tend to see, is an over response, and it's nature and nurture. And there's things that we may miss or that we do to make that behavior happen. And in different environments, it could be very different. Like they could live in my house and be fine, but then they go to someone, you know, if you foster, you go to someone else's house and they can't handle it because the person isn't able to create the environment that supports them.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to point out for everybody who's watching, Chelsea Murray actually did a reactive dog webinar for us. So that's available on Show Dog Prep School. I know Chelsea does remote sessions for this. Do any of you other ladies offer remote sessions for reactivity?
Yeah.
I mean, I will if it's for a show dog only. But I have to tell you guys, before we jump into Chelsea's thoughts on what she thinks the cause are, I have to say, you guys, like I did for years before I did only confirmation, I did in-home behavior consulting for years. Mm-hmm. So I did all sorts of classes and then going to people's houses. And it got to the point where I didn't even want to take reactive dog cases. And it was because client buy-in, owner compliance, meaning that they actually do the homework that you give them, is very difficult for these cases.
And that's I kind of stopped taking reactivity cases for the same reason. And I don't find it a hard behavior to improve on. It takes a long time and you have to do the work. But I didn't find it onerous. Of course, maybe that's why I'm a professional dog trainer. So one of the things I offered, and I didn't get a lot of buy-in on it, was walk and trains, where I would train the dog a couple times a week and then we would hand off and the owner would walk together and I would transfer so that the dog had the skills and the experience and then the owner could take those skills and watch and then I could coach them. And the couple of case people that did do that, we had a lot of success, but a lot of people just didn't, you know, they just wanted a magic wand or something.
Oh yeah.
Well, I think one of the problems too with reactivity is that by the time we as trainers get a call, the clients are so exhausted. You know, they're seeing this reactivity in so many different facets of their life. It's not just on a walk. It's not just at a dog show. It's through the front door and every time the dog hears a noise. And so by the time we get a phone call, they're like, please help me and fix this as fast as you can.
Yeah.
You know, so for a lot of my clients, I don't find that buy-in is challenging, but everybody's just so exhausted. And it's like, can we fix this as soon as possible? Because everybody is feeling the stress from it.
Yeah, I agree. Chelsea, what do you see as, or what's your opinion on the general causes of reactivity? Yeah. Which are usually barking, lunging, carrying on the leash kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I live a little more in the city too. So a lot of my clients live in condos and apartments. And so we have a lot of street traffic. We have a lot of people walking by other people's homes. So I see a lot of reactivity in addition to on leash behavior. We see it through the fence. We see it through windows. We hear noises through apartment walls. And so generally by the time I get a phone call, it's not just one trigger or one thing that the dog is responding to. It's usually a variety. And the problem with reactivity too, is that, you know, the dog is experiencing stress. And once that stress level increases, you know, they're more likely to be set off by other triggers. They're more likely to be pushed into that reactive state by other noises or other things that they're feeling. And so oftentimes we kind of have to look at that life as a whole and figure out how we can reduce that overall stress level to help the dog feel more comfortable, to give them a little bit more of a safe space where they can feel emotions and not be pushed past that point where they feel the need to have that big response. You know, like Paula said, it's complicated and there's a lot of different causes for it. It's certainly, there are certain breeds that are more likely to be predisposed to having reactivity based on breed temperament traits. Genetics certainly plays a part. Early socialization with breeders plays a part. Socialization with the owners plays a part. But I will say with all of that, you know, going the right way, I certainly have had clients where they've met all of those boxes in a really positive way and set the puppy up for the best chance. And sometimes we still see it. So it's really complicated. But I think the good news for people is that we as trainers don't necessarily need to know what is causing it in order to give the owner and the dog relief from the situation.
I think that's a good point, because for me, any sort of reactivity, meaning I'm talking mostly about leash reactivity, so for this particular comment, but whether it's the dog's afraid or overstimulated or excited, I mean, generally my protocol for training, it's going to be pretty much the same. Is that how you guys deal? Like, it doesn't matter if the dog's excited or afraid. Whatever, the dog is telling me that in this environment, with this particular trigger, we call it, which is the thing that's making the dog go off. And it could be another dog. It could be a car. It could be a cat. It could be a person. It could be little kids. There's a million things it could be. But in this instance, the dog is saying, I can't function right now in this environment.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Well, I use pretty much the same techniques, but there might be some nuanced differences in how they're applied or what I use as the reinforcer for the desired behavior. You know, like a dog that's maybe ramping up towards reactivity to other dogs, but it's based on frustration that's manifested because they want to greet.
Yeah.
Maybe I will let them meet the other dog contingent upon getting calm behavior. Whereas obviously if it's a dog that's uncomfortable, we're going to get more space and just work on pairing. But, you know, the essential thing is, right, I'm looking for the same behavior, but how the nuanced application will vary depending on, you know, probably the emotion behind
it. Yeah. I wanted to say real quick too, because Chelsea kind of hit on this, but when this is ongoing, like a dog is reacting on a daily basis. So this is particularly important. If you have a dog who's reacting at the fence line at your house or at your front window, like those dogs are frequently living in a constant state of anxiety and high stress. And so that affects all different parts of our body. You know, it can actually make them pretty sick. It can create gut issues. It can create all sorts of other things. So it's not just that it's annoying barking for us. It's that these dogs are really suffering and they actually really need some relief and some help. So I just wanted to kind of point that out.
I think that's important too, to look at, Vicky, because when we talk about our reactive dogs, oftentimes, like as a trainer, I get phone calls from people and they're struggling with teaching their dog obedience, right? They're struggling getting certain behaviors from their dog. I just want my dog to pay attention. I just want my dog to be able to walk on a loose leash. Why can't my dog sit and stay? Why I need them to stop these things. Mm-hmm. But in order for a dog to effectively learn, just like a human, you know, they need to feel safe. All of their base level needs need to be met. And so when we look at these training plans, like Andrea mentioned, like the foundation is the same. We need management to make sure that we're doing what we can to reduce or prevent, you know, but working with the trainer, there are little things that we can see and tweak depending on the age of the dog and the breed of the dog. And if we start going through a protocol and we go, you know what, that's actually stressing the dog out more. Or you know what, this is a teenager and that dog wants to stay in motion. Instead of stopping, let's keep them moving. Let's do a circle. You know, so I think the nice thing to know about reactivity is that, yes, while the base level stays the same and while we do need to make sure we're keeping an eye on that overall stress level and reducing it where possible, there are always things in the program that we can tweak if you aren't finding success.
Absolutely.
I want to point out that you, Vicki and Chelsea, brought this up about the stress levels and like all the chemicals that are released and that sort of thing. The other component, you know, I said nature and nurture, is pain or a medical problem. So if these things, whether they creep up over time or they're all of a sudden your dog's acting out, there may be something that's not right. I have a 15-year-old dog now, but when he was younger, he was great with other dogs interacting. And then all of a sudden, he started fussing at dogs smelling his rump. Mm-hmm. And it was very out of character. And for years, I didn't know why until I learned that there was a dog chiropractor and he had some misalignment. And once he was aligned and he was feeling good again, it just went away. And so you have to look at the whole picture. And sometimes that's a test and see, you know, what is the right answer? Because there isn't a perfect recipe. I mean, we would all just be like, here's the protocol. We have to look at the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to touch on, Chelsea brought up management. So I just want to talk about that for a second. So people know that even if, you know, whatever the behavior issue is, if the behavior is not fixed and how you want it, there are other things we can do that aren't necessarily training, but they can manage us through situations. So we can maybe decrease the dog's stress a little bit more, prevent reactions from happening. So like, for instance, if you're walking with a dog and you see another dog coming, you could duck behind a car or throw kibble on the ground so the dog starts eating. You guys want to talk about management a little bit and just ways that people can like cope with this just long enough to really get some training and behavior mod on board?
I just wanted to throw out there, one of the reasons management while you're training is so important is, you know, we talked about stress and all that. All those cortisol dumps that your dog gets every time it has a big explosion, those chemicals stay in their body for 3 to 6 days and they make a reaction even more likely. So yes. It's like this big old snowball. So, right. You know, that's why management while you train is so important so that your dog can continue to learn once you've started.
Totally. And then I've talked about it. Chelsea talks about it in her reactivity webinar, but trigger stacking, where it's just like, and you know, the dog is constantly trigger stacked if they're living in a state of like I've worked with people who will call me over and I go there and it's like, when was the last time this dog went a day without having a reaction? If they tell me that never happens, I'm like, don't even leave the house with this dog for 3 days. Like this dog needs to detox, like just come down. Because if the dog, I mean, imagine if you're just like, I don't know, living with someone you hate, or like Paula said, even if you're, you know, having horrible chronic pain all the time, like there's things that can trigger it, that can make it like it's going to happen even faster.
I think the important thing to remember too about reactivity and behavior in general is that when a behavior happens, it becomes more normal, you know? And so if I've got a high arousal teenager and I'm playing fetch all the time, I'm making high arousal behavior more normal and more common for the dog. If I've got a reactive dog and they're constantly reacting to everything, it doesn't matter if I'm working through a behavior modification training plan, if they're also then experiencing all of those stressors all the time, because that behavior is getting more normal. So the management not only helps the human keep their sanity because it reduces the amount of reactions the dog is happening.
Right.
But it also helps the dog feel more comfortable, and it helps us from a training standpoint then get our foot in the door and go, okay, so I'm going to make sure this reactive behavior isn't getting stronger. I don't want more pennies going in the piggy bank for this behavior. So we need to use management, which is crates, baby gates, closed blinds, music to drown out noise, tarps on our fence to block lines, distance on walks, right? We need to use all these things strategically to help prevent the dog from being put in a scenario where this reactive behavior is going to happen. And that helps us be in a better place from a training standpoint, because then we're cutting off that reinforcement. We're making sure that behavior is not getting stronger, where we can then go in and say, okay, what behavior do I want to replace this with, right? I don't want barking and lunging at the end of the leash. I want whatever that might be. And then we work on a training plan, right, to not only make those behaviors more likely, but to kind of undo all of that work emotionally that was causing that reactive behavior.
Exactly. So anybody else have anything on that before we move on?
I was going to say, like, the biggest thing of management is you don't have to walk your dog every day. Like,
oh, thank you.
you really don't. You know, I get, like, apartments, you know, that's a little bit different, but, like, a lot of the reactive dogs that I see are ones that are, you know, in neighborhoods all the time. And it's like, we walk them like for him. And it's like, well, he's having a bad time every time you walk him, and you walk every day. Like, he's, you know, he's avoiding the harness when you go to put him on. He's mounting the harness. He's already getting over aroused before you even go outside.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to do it. And the only times you really want to do it is when you're ready to work on it, you know, or if you want to walk him and he likes sniffing, but he doesn't like the triggers, take him somewhere else. You know, it's like your dog doesn't have to be constantly outside, you know, on the walk if it's scary to your dog.
Yeah, they can get access to them. Sniff spots are so cool, right? For dogs that can't walk in their neighborhood successfully, taking advantage of sniff spots is really great, because, you know, some of them are fully fenced and, you know, there's nobody else out there. So that's something that, you know, I think is great for clients too.
And there's so many other outlets for that energy. You know, we've got training, we've got go in the woods on a long line walk, you know, get out of the city. We've got enrichment. There are so many other ways that we can channel that energy.
Conditioning work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to point out one thing too, because, oh my gosh, I don't even have the comments on. There's like a million comments. Okay. Streaming back up. Hello. Hello. Hi, everybody. Hi there. Hi, Anita. Hi, Jordan. Hi, Megan. Hello, everybody. Everybody. Yes, we will be asking for questions in a second. There's no questions, but we'll come back to some of these after. But I wanted to say that when I taught puppy classes, my puppy classes evolved over the years that I trained puppy classes. But when I ended them, meaning when I stopped doing them, where I had landed was that the dogs would come in, the puppies would start out with a little bit of training. Then we would do a little bit of lecture where they would get rewarded for just being calm. Then we would do a little bit of play. Then we would call them out of the play. And then we would let them, you know, go back. And then we also did like some dogs leashed while some played and learning how to be calm around that. But I want to say that I saw a lot of dogs that sort of their reactivity, which this is not a bad thing, is that they went to a puppy class, they got to play with every puppy they saw, and then they go into the real world, and then they're 6 months old, so they don't get to do that anymore. Now they have no friends to play with. And we're saying, oh, I don't know if you really want to go to the dog park. That's not always such a safe thing. So then now the people are walking their dog who goes nuts every time he sees a dog because he never gets to play with a dog. Do you guys see that?
Oh, I see a ton of that in the city, especially with people that, you know, send their dogs out to daycares and stuff, which I normally don't recommend, but we get these dogs that are so hyper fixated on other dogs, and all of their experiences around other dogs are high arousal playtime and getting to be with the other dogs. So the second we put a leash on them and they can't be with them, the frustration levels are through the roof.
Right.
You know, so a lot of the times in our group classes and when people are like, I need to work on, you know, we want social time around dogs. I'm like, great. We're going to sit down and it's going to look boring. We're going to do nothing.
Yeah.
Because the dogs are learning how to coexist with other dogs. You know, they're learning how to relax.
And it's not as sexy as like all
right,
of the-
right. It doesn't look like we're doing much. Yeah. But in reality, you're giving the dog real life skills that most dogs struggle with, which is the ability to just be around other dogs and be around distractions. And I think that that's a really good point about reactivity. It is that it's not just fear-based. It's not just a dog that's so overwhelmed with negative emotions about the world. It can very easily happen for a dog that has tons of positive emotions, but they just are lacking that ability to control it.
Well, and I would say probably that was the biggest overexcitement to greet other dogs was the biggest cause of on-leash reactivity that I dealt with. Because when I was teaching group classes and taking privates, it was in Seattle, like, you know, right in the middle of the city. So that's almost bar none the leading cause that I saw.
I want to just hit Silky's comment. Think it's a bit flooding situation at shows. I think that that can actually be really true. Not always, but for sure. You know, if sometimes, like I said, it's the sudden environmental change. It's the dog that's like, oh my God, there's a dog that shouldn't be there. Or there's a thing that shouldn't be there. Or there's a dumpster that shouldn't be there. Or there's a recycle bin that shouldn't be there. Or there's, you know, whatever that the dog goes, oh my God. But there also, to Silky's point, there actually could be where either the dog gets in big trouble for reacting, so they just stop, right? They haven't learned how to feel comfortable with it. But if you punish them enough, sometimes they shut down. And that's pretty much what flooding does. It's if you just immerse the dog in the situation and not give them a way to get out or to protect themselves, then frequently they'll stop reacting. But it doesn't mean they're okay. It just means that, you know, we've sort of squelched that for now. Any comments on that? Everybody's muted but me.
Well, I
have these things on, so I feel like I'm not really sure if I'm hearing.
Puppies running around and growling.
I think the flooding at a dog show certainly, you know, can happen, but I don't think that's always the reason we see dogs that are okay in one context and not another.
Because, I agree.
You know, as I mentioned, some dogs are just, you know, or dogs in general are super contextual. And like for my own dogs who tend to be more reactive on walks than at dog shows, I think a lot of it is because when we're at a dog show, we have a routine. They know what they're supposed to do. When my dog is on a leash, I'm working that dog. We are doing something. As opposed to in the neighborhood where we're just like tra-la-la and then one dog maybe shows up, you know.
Yeah,
I think there's probably a lot of telltale signs if the dog is flooding, if you haven't been like, you know.
Yeah, but that brings up the point that part of this is always like really being able to look at the dog, measuring what's happened. If you're doing something either as a training situation, you know, to try and change the behavior, measuring if it's working, if things are getting better or worse, what's happening. And then looking at the dogs at dog shows, looking at if they're having stress when they're there or anxiety. You know, if you go to a dog show and your dog is fine, but can't eat food and, you know, is having diarrhea and is skittering around the ring, then probably he's not okay, especially if he got pounded for, you know, being worried. But if you have a dog who's really like, oh yeah, we're at the dog show, cool, got it. And some dogs are like I've had dachshunds that are like, oh, I'm cool by the dachshund ring. Don't bring those Irish wolfhounds over here because we can get reactive. And it'll happen right at the dog show. They'll like, sometimes you'll have like a specialty going on, right? And it's all like, I'm just saying dachshunds because they can have big mouths and sometimes this will happen. And then somebody walks through with their other breed and it's like, get out of here. Where you belong here. And it's like, dude, relax. You know what I mean? But it does that for them.
Well, and I think that's a good point to bring up, Vicky, too, is that it's so important for people in general who own dogs to be really well-versed in reading dog body language, because there are so many signals that the general pet home will not pick up on. You know, I've walked into homes where I would label, you know, for training purposes, I'd label the dog reactive, but to them, the dog looks totally fine. But the dog's not eating. And anytime there's a noise, there's a stutter. So it might not be that big, you know, barky, lungy, pulling at the leash type of picture that we envision and that we all talked about at the beginning. It can be as small as, you know, dropping the head, dropping the ears, and turning away. You know, I think the important thing to realize is that reactivity can look pretty different for dogs, you know, across the board, but it is a different than what we would consider normal reaction to something, you know, where we're seeing stress signaling from the dog. So it might not be that big, intense bark lunge. It could be, it could look more like fear. But it's always important to kind of check in with the dog, because if they can't take food, it's not that they're being stubborn. It's not that I don't have something high enough value most of the time. It's the fact that whatever else is going on around them is too much. And that stomach is turned off and they can't eat food. And if I've got a dog that can't eat food, it's not just that I can't do training with the dog, it's that the dog is not emotionally in a good place. It's not going to be a good environment to have them in.
Absolutely. And I would say over arousal might be right. You might not see that sort of shut down, canny, but you might also see instead, depending on the dog, over arousal where they're jumping up and they're jumping. They're not like coming, right? We call it height seeking. They're jumping up, right? But it's not like,
the dog asking for help.
It's like, yeah, it's like they're jumping at you, you know, and like getting the zoomies in the rally ring or the agility ring. That's, you know, people say, oh, your dog has so much drive. Well, no, your dog's probably over aroused because they can't handle what's going on and they're blowing off steam by running in circles.
Yeah, I see a lot of fool around and a lot of the clients that we work with, it's like, they're fool around in other contexts, so they seem like they're fine, but like they're really, I have a dog come in and they're like, oh my God, this is so great. They're jumping everywhere. And I'm like, this is not a super normal excitement level. Like this is a little over the top, but you know, it's not Christmas Day, like every day. And you know, then you see that shift from that super high arousal to reactive high arousal, like instantly, because they're already up there and they're always going to, you know, be up there, and they still are struggling to, you know, regulate themselves. It's all the same, but it just looks different and it's not as scary. So people don't recognize it the way it is. But, you know, if it contextually happens every single time when I hand my leash to the vet tech and my dog jumps all over them and gets really, you know, silly, it might be less of an I love you and more of a like, oh, I don't really like this, but
please help me.
You know, I find that they tend to be like somewhat social dogs who, you know, just don't know how to deal with their own emotions. And they, you know, it's like the person who, like, Paula laughs when she gets nervous. So, you know, she's over here laughing and everyone else is freaking out. She looks kind of, she looks like she's having a great time, but she's really not.
Yeah. You know? Well, and so much of that has to do with body language, because I just bring up this breed in response to that comment, because I've seen it a lot with Cavaliers where people are like, oh, look, she's so friendly. But the mouth is like all the way wide open. It's not just like a relaxed, the tail's low and it's like wagging like this. And everything's frantic and frenetic. It's not calm and soft and relaxed. I want to talk a little bit because I want to make sure we get through these questions. But let's just kind of blast through what you should not do. Like, what do you not want to do? I'm just going to start and say, the very common thing to do is to, especially if you're somebody who has dogs forever, and basically your go-to is, I reward the dog when they do something good and I punish the dog when they do something bad. So when the dog does something bad, meaning barks at another dog or lunges, and sometimes it's because, frankly, the person's embarrassed and just wants to look like they're doing something, they'll physically correct the dog. And if the dog stops, they think, oh, look, it's fixed, but I think all of us here would argue that we're really just kind of creating a ticking time bomb by saying, you know, we're just going to put a lid on this behavior instead of really get to the issue of what's happening.
Well, and that might even just create a chained behavior, right? Where the dog reacts, you go, and then they stop. And you never actually see a decrease in the dog initiating the behavior. It's just
suppressing the behavior in that moment.
Right.
Well, and yeah. I think if you look at it for reactivity, especially, like, you might temporarily stop the barking if the punishment is intense enough. Mm-hmm. The problem is the reactivity is more like a symptom of what's happening internally, right? And so not only are you not addressing those emotions, which is really causing the reactivity, but you're likely making it worse because the dog goes, okay, every time I see another dog, something crummy happens to me,
right?
You know, and so I might temporarily stop the barking, but in the long run, that's likely going to rear an ugly head at me.
Yeah, because you've now given the dog two things to worry about, the other dog, right, and then getting pummeled by the owner for not being comfortable with it. And and frankly, most of the time, these dogs do that because that is their best solution in that moment. They do not have another idea, or they would do it. You know, that those reactions don't feel good generally. You know, it's not usually an enjoyable thing. It's like a reaction because the dog just is reacting and doesn't know what else to do instead. So what else should we not do?
So I would say from the polar opposite, we talked about management, but Andrea said it beautifully, is management with training. You don't want to just go 100% management,
right,
and avoid. So we don't want to put them in the situation and, like, you know, flood them or punish them. But we also don't want to say we're just not going to do X ever. We're not going to, you know, we're going to live in a bubble, because management ultimately at some point will fail. Someone will leave a door open. A leash or collar will break. You know, things happen. So we need to work on it. But we don't want to just go, oh, I'm just going to manage their entire life and hope for the best.
I'm going to interject with the worst management I've ever seen in my entire life. And Paula will remember this. It was a year-old German Shepherd who was always on a four-foot tether on the fridge for its entire life. He was inside or he was outside. And he was always tethered on that. The dog could not exist in that home because he was never taught how to do it. They just stopped him from being, like, bad by literally not letting him 4 feet away from the fridge. And number one, I thought the fridge is probably the worst place to do that. But, you know, it's like you build no skills when you're saying, okay, well, we're just going to avoid everything. And yeah, it works. But management is always going to fail. When that dog got off of the leash, they couldn't catch that dog because he was zooming in the whole house. He had no manners. He couldn't do anything because we'd never learned how to do it. You know, so it's like, okay, yeah, it's temporarily a fix, but it's not ever going to actually, you know, do anything. And I think there's a difference between management and deciding what is appropriate and not appropriate for your dog. Like, yeah. I wouldn't take, you know, a reactive dog to Bass Pro Shop, you know, I just wouldn't. But, you know, there's a difference between, like, adjusting a little bit and deciding what is and isn't right for your dog, and then building skills.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, management is just stopping the expression of the unwanted behavior.
Right.
But the problem is still there. And as soon as you put the dog in the same setting, it's going to come right back if you haven't given them any skills.
Exactly. And actually that, you know, punishing to suppress the behavior in the moment is actually, you know, poor management. I mean, it's like they're just doing it and getting through the situation. I'm going to talk real quick about a dog that I'll say I showed him, and he was dog reactive and finished, you know, but I was always working on it. And then eventually the dog went with a handler and you didn't see any reactivity. Like, he was, had a huge career and did very well. And then, you know, when he went home after his career was over, they pretty much had to get rid of all the dogs in the house. And my feeling is that it probably, the behavior was suppressed through years of just, like, doing this thing, but not really addressing it. Mm-hmm. So I just feel like, you know, I want to comment real quick on this, or respond to this comment from Jamie. And I know Jamie has Faro hounds, so I'm assuming you're talking about a Faro. So we have a Faro hound trainer on here, so that's interesting too. Any suggestions for managing a dog reactive dog that is under constant stress at home just because it's a multi-dog household? Not reactive like lunging and other dogs constantly, but clearly shows signs of stress and hyper-awareness. I'm going to respond, and then I'm going to let everybody else respond. And I really thought it was important to respond to this, Jamie, but I'll tell you that something big for me would need to change. So the only deal breaker, I have a lot of dogs. The deal breaker for being a dog in this house is if you cannot live in a home with a lot of dogs, because there are a lot of dogs here and they will be coming and going. And I feel like the prognosis for a dog that's reactive with other dogs in the household, I would say part of it depends on, you know, a lot of things. Like, is he a new dog? Is he a young dog? The question is he ever going to be okay? And by okay, I mean, not just not reactive, but like, is he okay living in that situation? What do you guys, any thoughts or comments on that?
My first thought was just that, you know, this poor dog, right? He's not comfortable in his own home. And that would be probably my priority, would be trying to figure out a way how or if I can get this dog to the point where he's just comfortable being around.
Yeah. I want to say real quick too, that it's like, sometimes people think, like, I've actually suggested people, I'm not saying this to you, Jamie, but I've suggested people rehome a dog because one dog is so intensely like living a life of terror because there's another dog in the home. And even though they're separated, that dog is always being targeted by the other dog and creating a huge amount of stress for that one dog. So, yeah, I agree with Andrea. Like, that's definitely something we want to, you know, make sure we can just figure out. And there may be ways to do that. Like, there may be ways to do it if it's not like dog fighting within, you know, certain individuals, or if it's like he's not reactive to the dogs in the house, but he's reactive out in life. Does that make sense? I think that that's different. Like, I have dogs that are reactive out in life, but they don't have any reactivity here.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you don't feel safe in your own home, like, there's no chance to set you up for success in any way, shape, or form. You know, if you're constantly on edge, it's kind of like, well, where's the starting line of your like baseline? It's non-existent because you're always on edge. So, you know, I think the biggest thing is, what is causing the dog's stress and hyperarousal? Is it dogs barking? Well, if you live in a house with a bunch of pharaohs, that's going to be an issue, you know. And it's like, if it's, they're comfortable around quiet dogs, or is it the crating? Is it the back and forth? Is it a wide variety of dogs? You know, there's a lot of stuff that can be an issue with a dog where you put them in a different situation and it's not an issue because it's not, you know, constantly trigger sagging, or they have some time to decompress, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I do a lot of, you know, I keep a lot of dogs who are born and trained. And I know Chelsea can kind of attest to this. And it's like, some dogs, they come in and they hear one bark and they're like, I'm out. I don't want to do this anymore. You know, a single bark freaks them out. And it's just, you know, it is who they are. And so we work on, like, it's okay if that dog, you know, has a little, you know, something to say. You don't have to panic. But it's much easier to work with its one dog and one dog barking versus a bunch of dogs barking and a dog who's trapped with them all the time, you know, doing that. So it's kind of, you know, you want to see what's causing the issue to start with. Why are you uncomfortable? And then start to kind of address that. And you could add some, you know, natural calming stuff to, like, an adaptive collar and other.
Hannah, you calming. do remote sessions for this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Canine Country Academy. So yeah. Jamie, you certainly could contact Hannah directly to work with her too.
And I was just going to say, you know, it's probably your part of your setup, you know, your home, how big it is, how you can divide it up, where you can put dogs, you know, if you need to temporarily separate or create like a safe space for the one dog, you know, that's going to be a big factor. Like, if you're in a tiny apartment with, you know, 10 Havanese and one of them can't handle the barking versus, you know, if you have a nice big house and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention something similar to that too. You know, and in addition to physical space, it also comes down to emotional capacity of the human. You know, lots of people live with divided households in multi-dog households for a variety of reasons, whether it's reactivity, whether it's, you know, food aggression, dog-directed aggression, human-directed aggression. But at the end of the day, like, that takes a lot out of the human caregivers. So you always have to address not only what's best for the dog, but also what's best for the human and what you're realistically capable of doing. So I think that if living in home is becoming stressful for you and for the dog, it's absolutely time to bring a professional in to help you evaluate that and kind of address some of those tricky situations. Sometimes it's an easy fix. Sometimes it's something we have to dive a little deeper into, but everybody deserves the right to feel safe and comfortable in their own home.
And I think a lot of times we put guilt on, you know, people feel guilt if there's something, I can't do this. And, you know, I think if you're trying to do the right thing for the dog, there really shouldn't be guilt there.
Yeah.
And well,
I always like to tell people too, they're like, gosh, well, I've done everything. And I'm like, well, you've just done everything that you know.
Yeah.
And that's, it's time to bring someone else in.
Exactly. And I will say, as a professional dog trainer for 12 years, 2 years ago, I had to bring in Suzanne Clother to help me with two of my dogs who were having issues, and they now get along. But, you know, going through that process took time to unpack it and to kind of learn. I mean, I help people with that all the time. Like, I've had so much
I know, stuff. But sometimes it's really, I mean, as we all know, because I probably talked to all of you about training stuff, like, this is what professionals do. In my opinion, if you're a good trainer, you're bouncing stuff all the time off your colleagues. You're always like, dude, what do you think about this? What would you do? So it's not like, you know, I'm Vicky, so I just handle everything here. It's like, no, I was like on the, you know, computer with my vet about Mary and messaging Anna about her supplements. And, you know, because for one thing, not everything is my area of expertise, but not only that, but I'm so emotionally invested that I can't even make decisions always based on what's right because I'm wrapped up in it emotionally.
Yes.
Yeah,
and it's been going on for a while. At some point, you kind of get desensitized to it. So you don't see it. Like, and you know, and like Hannah and I work together. So Hannah will be like, did you notice that? And I'm like, what? You know, like, could you live with it? Right.
Yeah.
Someone else can see it and point, like, oh, this, did you not notice this? And you're like,
well, I mean, I can't count the number of times I've been into a household and I'm like, you live with this every single day? Like, how do you live with this? And they're just like, well, it's just, you know, it is what it is. And I was like, that's not like comfortable for anybody. You know, you're living with two dogs who are trying to kill each other every day. And you're just like, well, that's fine. You know, sometimes they, you know, put it on each other. It's fine. You know, yeah, it's crazy. But if you can't have someone who's removed, and, you know, I've done the same thing. I've gone to Nancy Reyes a few times and been like, hey, can you help me with this? Because I can't, I'm kind of, you know, not really sure how I'm supposed to approach it, because all I see is my dog being a pain in the butt. Yeah. You know, because that's just what it is in my brain.
Right.
So I need to like have someone to remove and say, you know, what we need to work on X, Y, or Z. And it just helps to kind of have someone else there to work on it separately.
Absolutely. So Dane asked, how likely is reactivity passed on through genetics? I would say that genetics is always a part of who the individual is. So a piece of that at least, but I really feel like how we handle this early on is just can be a game changer. Cause I've had people who, you know, they were told their dog is reactive when they had, you know, they barked at a person one time and it's like, and I'm like, oh, just do this and this and this. And it's sort of like, I'm not saying it just goes away, but it's like, it wasn't a whole reactive case. It was like the dog was 5 months old and decided he would see what happens if he barks at someone. So I think that how we deal with it early on can certainly, you know, affect that. Do you guys agree with that?
Totally. Well, I mean, like whenever somebody asks, well, is it nature or nurture, right? Is it genetics or training? The answer is it's always both. It's always both, right? Because your genetics sort of lay that giant roadmap of like who your dog could become and the environment and setting that your dog grows up in and the training and all that sort of helps guide them to where they are. But you know, so it's never just one or the other. It's always both.
Absolutely.
I would say there's some traits that might be innate in a dog that would make them more likely to be reactive. And dogs that are very vigilant or aware of their surroundings, you know, so maybe like your hunting dogs, like sighthound type dogs that are always looking for stuff to kill, or herding dogs because they have to, and a high level of arousal. So if those are happening together, it might make your dog more likely to be reactive, but
yeah.
Well, maybe you could have great, you know, breeding pairs and not have any traits, and then that one puppy.
Yep.
You know, it's like all of these dogs are great. There's never been an issue. And then there is. I mean, you know, there's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Some of the traits that can make a dog more likely to be reactive, I personally enjoy. Like, I like my, you know, ready to get in there, you know, prey-driven dogs that want to go out coursing and they want to do the thing and they want to play pug and they got a lot of fire in the belly. And I like that, so I select for that. But the flip side of that is in the right, or I guess the wrong set of circumstances, they might be more reactive, you know.
Yeah. I want to see, we have 10 minutes left, and I want to see if we can tell people what they should do. I am going to, I know. So basically, my go-to is desensitization and counter conditioning and some classical conditioning sometimes too. But I don't want to explain it because I just feel like Chelsea is so good at explaining this. So one of you guys, but I'm kind of threw Chelsea under the bus on that one. You know, what's a simple way? Do you think there's a simple way to explain what desensitization and counter conditioning is?
So desensitization is very slowly getting the dog used to something. It's starting at, we'll say, let's say we're talking about a sound. If I record a doorbell and I turn it on at the lowest possible volume my phone can go on, and the dog has absolutely no reaction. And over time, I just very slowly hit that volume button and it goes up and up and up. And this could take place over several weeks or months. The dog is having no reaction the whole time until eventually that volume is at full capacity and there's no reaction from the dog. So it's very slowly getting the dog used to that stimuli. Counter conditioning is often used when a dog already has a negative association with, we'll say, this trigger. So again, a doorbell. If when the doorbell rings, your dog is barking, then that means your dog already has emotions built up against this noise. And so in that case, what I do is use counter conditioning, and I do also use desensitization. So I would take this noise and I want to pair it with something really good so that over time, basically that noise that used to trigger this barking response because the dog felt stressed, now the dog has so many repetitions, we'll say, of doorbell cookie that now the dog hears the doorbell and they turn and look at me like, hey, where's my treat? But it's a little more complicated than that, right? Like, that's the really stripped down version. But I use a combination of the two because what we don't want to put the dogs in a state of stress, right? And if they're already in a state of reactivity, then it's really not a functional place of learning. The dog is then over their threshold or over their tolerance. So what I like to do is, again, take that recording of the doorbell, turn it down really low, and we play games where maybe one time the doorbell is on really, really low playing in the background and I'm doing hand targets and settle on a mat. And it's almost just so quiet that it's a distraction, right? And that would be desensitization. It's on background in the noise, really quiet. And over time that can build up. And for the dogs that have really big feelings about something, and this goes to like prey drive reactivity too, then I like to pair the sight, the smell, the sound with something good. So I stand far enough away from the trigger or turn the volume down low enough, there's still no reaction, but I can then pair experiencing that trigger with a treat. And over time, when we can do that, we start to get rid of the reactivity, right? Air quotes, get rid of the reactivity because I'm replacing those negative emotions with positive ones by turning the presence of that trigger into something positive for the dog.
So basically, what she's saying is that we're just exposing the dog to the thing a little bit at a time while pairing that exposure with something the dog really likes. And I would add that we talk a lot about thresholds when we're doing reactive dogs. So if your dog is over threshold, then it's too close. Like, the dog needs to be able to, these are my questions in From Shy to Showy, which is available as a webinar and a class. And Chelsea's reactive dog webinar gets into this too, but we're actually wanting to make sure that we keep the dog under threshold. So we need to make sure that the dog can hear us, eat food, do normal behaviors that they know how to do on cue. Like if I ask the dog to look at me, he can. If they can't peel their eyes away from the thing, they're too close. If they can't eat food, if they can't breathe, like I've seen dogs actually hold their breath. They're so tense. They're just like, and you're like, okay, this isn't good. So I want to address a question by Grace. She said, does dropping treats when a dog starts to bark reward the dog for barking? Our trainer recommended doing that, but I wasn't sure whether that reinforces barking. So this is a wonderful question. And, you know, years ago, I used to see Jean Donaldson speak a lot because she was here in this area and she did a lot of reactive dog work. And that was always a big thing. Like people were like, I don't want to feed the dog when it's reacting. And I'll tell you, of course, I mean, that's our dream choice, right? Is that we're not over threshold. But when Mai brought Jenny home, or when somebody brought her and dumped her here, I should say, because she had already laid open a vet and was living in a home with little kids at 3.5 months old. If I walked that dog down the street, she would snarl and lunge at 3.5 months old at people across the street. Snarl and lunch. Now, if you saw her today, you would say, I don't believe you. She's lovely. She was not lovely when she was a baby. It was actually really intense and scary. So honestly, I always tried to keep people at a distance, but as soon as she noticed anything, I literally threw a handful of chicken at her. It was just like that scary thing makes this happen. And then what happens really, really quickly is that she went from looking at the thing to looking at me. So now it just goes from classical conditioning, meaning, you know, scary things are predictive of chicken. It's like she now has learned, I will make a decision to look away from that thing and look at her and get paid. So now I've got an operant learned behavior on board. So I would say the dream choice would be that you could get that food on the ground after the dog notices the trigger, but before they start barking. Or literally, you see the thing, you turn with your dog. I teach a turn and go this way, and we just get out of there. It's a management skill, but sometimes it becomes a training skill if you just need 15 feet and then the dog can cope, right? So I might just move the dog away, re-engage the dog, and then, you know, they might not need to go into barking. Does that make sense?
I totally agree. And I would say, you know, to try to answer the question directly, if you kept putting your dog in a situation where it was going over threshold and barking, and then you were dropping food on the ground over enough time, if you just kept repeating that, maybe you would be reinforcing the barking. But that's really sort of like when your dog is over threshold and you're throwing food on the ground, you're really, like you said, with the chicken, you're really just stopping the baby from sticking its finger into the light socket. Right? You're just trying to get the dog out of that response so you can move away. And then in the future, like, okay, I need to keep more distance. I need to get better, you know, I need to teach a dog a turn and go or look at me or some other way to get them out of there. You don't want to keep putting the dog over threshold. But in the short term, no, you're not reinforcing it because the dog is in an emotional response. It's not thinking, oh, I'm going to bark at that dog and mommy's going to give me a cookie. It's going, oh my God, a dog. Blah, blah, blah. You're not reinforcing that emotion. If it happens a few times while you're training other skills. No. So
yeah, I also, just to even make it a little bit more complicated, you can actually poison the food by screwing this up. That's why it's really important to have a good trainer on board, because if you just go out there and you're a little bit late, and you know what I mean? Like, you could actually tell the dog that the good thing makes a scary thing happen.
Yeah. So I've seen that happen a bazillion times.
Yeah, order matters.
Yeah. Yeah, timing, and you know, and that's why punishment tends to shoot you in the foot, because I have people who cannot click to save their life. And then you pair that and try and, you know, shock a dog for doing something. And it's like, you are messing this up completely. Yeah. You're really, I don't know what you're trying to do. But I mean, you know, I get a lot of people who struggle to mark before the sight. And so I teach a positive interrupter too. Like, hey, even if you're starting to, if you can come back, I'll still pay. Or, yeah, I will still pay if you, you know, I have people who are like, well, should I pay that? And I'm like, well, they stopped barking and they looked back at you. You know, so yeah, you should. You know, there's really nothing that gets you in trouble outside of if you start barking, we'll move away. But I have dogs who go from like mega yelling to like, oh, I don't really know if I like this. And I'm like, yeah, pay that because that's better than barking. And then we'll go, we'll slowly decrease, you know, we'll increase the criteria and say, you know, you get quieter and quieter. And now it's just going to look and that's what's going to pay. And, you know, you get dogs who are like, oh, okay, so I don't have to do that then. Because most dogs don't want to do it. You know, it's, you know, most of the dogs are not, they don't have any other option because they don't think that anything else exists. So if you could teach them other things, that you could literally do anything, spin in a circle, look at me, look down, look away, you know, look at the dog, they'll bark. Anything but bark usually gets you stuff. It tends to, you know, smooth out that process pretty heavily.
One of my little training, my offered tools that I like to use in reactivity is look at that. So I reward them for looking at the scary thing and then coming back to me. Of course, you have, you guys know, you have to build that up, but I love using look at that, especially because you can use it when you are in a situation where your dog is probably going to be over threshold. Like if you have to walk past that house that always has that giant barking dog running back and forth behind the fence, you've got to have a tool to get you past that. You know, if you know you're going to have to walk past it, or, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where, oh, I didn't think that dog was there today. Uh-oh. I really like look at that as a tool for working on reactivity and how, and also it's useful in management as well.
I always look at what the dog's saying. I've worked with some really sharp, like Malinois come to mind, where they're like, ba, ba, ba. And then they're like, hey, me. Right. So like ask the dog. So if you're doing something and the dog's like thinks it's something else, then you do want to change your approach at the same time, because I don't have the best timing either. Like I do my best, but I'm not wicked fast. And if I screw up and I have a dog who's forgiving, it's not so bad. But if you do have one of those really sharp, intelligent dogs, I'm sorry, but you are going to have to step it up because they're going to figure out a different thing that you're not actually saying.
Yeah, exactly. I want to address Jaina's question real quick. Is it possible for the handler's emotions or overstimulation in certain situations to cause reactivity in the dog? How do you recommend better containing handler emotions so the dog doesn't feed off them too much? Well, Jaina, I suck at that. So someone else should probably answer, because I am not good at having my own emotions in check when it comes to my dogs. However, I'm really good about telling other people to do it. But I mean, that's a real thing. Like just the same reason for needing to go to friends and other trainers to discuss stuff. I mean, it's not easy when you're very emotionally invested in the dog, because we don't realize it, but you could be walking with your dog, see a dog and just go, just slowly start wrapping the collar a little bit or the lead. And the dog's going, uh-oh, she's doing that thing. Where is it? So those little cues, or us just going like, or noticing, like we absolutely can become a cue that something bad's going to happen. So I think, I don't know how you ladies feel about this, but I think it's definitely something we have to practice as the owner.
I don't think you can cause reactivity in your dog, but I think if your dog is prone to reactivity, you can ratchet it up for sure. And as you said, if you're working on it, your little tells can be a cue to have a response.
And your dog is so in tune to you. This is true of Norby and I. It happens just in competitions or around other dogs. You know, I've gotten better at it, but I had to teach myself alternatives just like I would a client. So when you see a dog, relax your arm. Like, it's like you teach an alternative cue. If we have a weird encounter, I say, oh, look, it's a friend. And I say that when it's actual friends, so that his emotions and my emotions don't go, holy, you know, it's like, oh, it's a friend. And he's like, I love friends. But if I'm like, oh, then, you know, it's going to create a problem. So I train us both to have a different response.
Exactly. I think one of the things too, you know, when we talk about working with reactive dogs, like a lot of people are like, okay, well, my dog is reactive to other dogs, so I need to get out to a place with a bunch of other dogs, right? Yeah. And obviously, for any trainer, like that is our worst nightmare. We're like, no, you don't need to show me the reactivity. No, we're not going to go to the park. We're not going to go to the store.
Yeah,
we're going to have very structured and controlled environments. And those environments not only help the dog be successful, but I think if you're struggling with your own emotions and your own stress, which is totally reasonable, you know, if you're used to your dog having a big reaction, it's normal for you to predict that's going to happen and start to tense up, and then we can make it worse. But if we set up our training sessions appropriately, we're putting the dog in a situation where they're going to be successful, which means no reaction, which then also gives that human teammate a chance to like take a deep breath and handle it, you know, in the way that we should. Yeah. So I think that not only are like those structured training setups, but then also giving the owner a big toolbox. Like there are a lot of things you can do, even if this doesn't go as planned. You know, I can show you how to hold the leash, how to maintain your footing, even when you're getting, you know, drugged by a big dog. You know, we can teach you a variety of ways to happily get your dog's attention, to get you out of a situation. And so I think for someone that's struggling with their own emotions, I think we have to address, you know, why are those emotions happening? Can we get you a bigger toolbox so that you feel more confident in your ability to handle this situation?
Yeah.
And then let's reevaluate all of our training setups, because it probably means that we're in environments where we're uncomfortable handling the dog, which also probably means it's not a great environment for the dog to be learning.
Yeah. And also there's so much that a good trainer can teach you at home, so you can develop a lot of those skills before you even take it out on the road.
That's exactly my thought too. Is, you know, virtual, if you're not working with someone and you don't have someone near you, virtual is amazing because there's so much foundation you need. Working with no dogs, working with no other people, and then working with a stuffed dog, then working with the dog who's could care less if your dog barks at them. You know, these little bitty steps, but we want to just go straight out and expose them. But we wouldn't do that to ourselves. I mean, hopefully you wouldn't. So if Chelsea was worried about, you know, snakes, I wouldn't be like, let's go to my friend's snake shop, you know?
I'm going to throw you in a bathtub with them.
Yeah, we wouldn't do that. But we, with our dogs, you know, because it's like this big deal to us, it's our, you know, baby, we kind of rush things. And so we want to go at a snail's pace so that the dog's like, I'm rocking this. And the human is also seeing the success.
Yeah, there's a lot of like handler confidence issues that you as a trainer have to deal with. It's like, your dog can totally handle this, but you have to like take a deep breath and work through it. Cause I find a lot of people, you know, with reactive dogs freeze because they don't know what to do. And it's like, okay, well, your dog understands it, but you have to do all these steps. You know, I've had ones where I'm like, you know, we've done a lot of work and we're meeting at a park next time. And they're like, we can't meet at a park. And I'm like, we can meet at a park. We can totally do it. We're not going on a Saturday. We're not going to the dog park.
Yeah.
You know, we can meet, you know, in the middle of a work day or something. And, you know, we can take these steps, but, you know, handler confidence is a big issue with reactive dogs. If you feel like a failure, you hate walking your dog, which is something that you should enjoy. And you eventually start like resenting your dog because you just want to have a good time with your dog. So you get all these like emotions that tend to be tied into it. And it's just like, just take a moment. And if you work on it, the ones that I find are the most successful are the ones that I have to push to get to move farther because they are ready. And then once they do it, they're like, oh yeah, I just had a client who was, her dog couldn't be around other dogs at all, you know, from a distance, anything. We brought the stuffed dog out and he was like, I'm gonna like murder it. He's a Pomeranian, he's like this big, but you know, he's like, I'm gonna kill you from this distance, stay away. And she, you know, we did a lesson in my front field, we did a lesson at a park and he was like, I've got this. And it took about a month. And then she was like, I took him to a park and he did really good. He didn't react at all. And I was like, I know, because you put a lot of work into it. It's not just, you know, a quick fix. You actually put all that time and effort in, and it actually does come out. But sometimes that handler confidence really does impact it a lot. And when you have people who don't have enough skills to cope, okay, my dog's reacting. Well, what do I do now? You can't just stop and freeze because that doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to be able to kind of manage that. And once you do, and once you get those skills, it really smooths it out. But, you know, that's why I can take a reactive dog and walk it much better than an owner who has no handling skills. The handling skills themselves are really hard to learn if you're also dealing with a dog who's reacting. So if you can separate them, it tends to be really easy to learn the skills and then build up and ramp up. But if you're trying to do it, but the dog is losing their mind, it doesn't really help.
And honestly, for those, for our responses to become like, like when Rook started reacting, it's just like, I go into trainer mode and I just start working it. So, you know, when you have to like learn how to work it and then learn how to apply it, it can become stressful. So I think we should wrap up.
We need a whole nother live about the handler component, because there's the, you know, Hannah made me think of like, we need to detox. Like our lives are really stressful. I mean, more so than the current times we live in. And so if we're like level 10 on adrenaline of 0 to 10, and then we're like, no, we're going to take, you know, Norby out for a lesson, probably not the best idea.
Yeah.
Because we have a lesson with Hannah the next day, you know?
It's,
so this is a whole other component.
But yeah, I will add on to that. I always tell my clients, if you had a bad day at work, don't go work on your dog's reactivity, because it's going to it's going to go downhill, because you're in a bad headspace and you have to be in a really good headspace to work a reactive dog, because you are not going to add anything good into it if you're already frustrated or already like low tolerance.
You have to be patient and you have to be aware. And if your brain is foggy or stressed at all, you're not going to be able to do that. And then you're not going to be able to find success. So again, that kind of goes back to like, it's okay to not walk your dog. And on those days when you're not, when you don't have enough spoons, when you don't have enough energy, like it's okay to say, no, I can't do this. Give your dog another outlet and try again another day.
Absolutely.
I want to say that I will get on at some point over the next couple of days and try and address some of these questions. I did drop in Hannah and Paula and Chelsea's websites and Show Dog Prep Schools. Andrea, do you want to drop your, I don't know if you're actually taking reactive dog clients, but if you want to, look at her. She's like, no, I'm good. I'm just going to make dog tags over here. But, you know, certainly,
I'll make you a tag that says stay away. How's that?
I love that. But thank you guys so much. This was so fun. We had, you know, close to 60 people watching at one point. So I'm really excited. This is clearly a topic that's, you know, it's needed. It's very intense and much needed. So I hope we can get together and do more of these and maybe even do a little bit more on this topic. I do want to remind you guys that Hannah and Paula and Chelsea are all available to do these cases virtually online. And then Chelsea's got our reactive dog webinar that's offered as a recording, and she actually goes into some of the ways to deal with it. So when you're, if you're looking for practical stuff, it's really hard for us to say this is how you do it, because there's so many things we have to look at, and there's really not just like a recipe that I can rip out of this book and give you, because we're changing what we're doing in every, you know, second that we're working it. So thank you for watching. Thank you, everybody, for being here and answering these questions. We'll get more of these scheduled. I hope these ladies will be back, because this is a fun group. And I hope everybody has a great holiday. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.